Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition, available April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
We start this week with some rather scary COVID-19 numbers. Ontario has announced 700 new cases on Monday and a confirmation from the Premier that we are now officially in the second wave of this pandemic. 700 cases is the highest daily number the province has seen since the pandemic started in March. In today's podcast, we put that number into context and discuss the next steps for the government. Plus, an interview with a researcher who has studied the Ontario government's COVID-19 communication strategy. How effective has it been? Has it been consistent? Answers to those questions are coming on this Tuesday, September 29th, 2020. So let's get to it. JMM, we are testing more, so in some respects, it's not surprising to see the number of positive cases rising as well. Having said that, it is disappointing to see the numbers rising again fully 6.5 months after this pandemic began. So why don't you put all of this into context for us?
As you said in the intro, Ontario reported 700 new cases on Monday, the highest one-day number the province has ever seen. But let's put some caveats around that because, it can be important to give the context here. The last highest date we saw, we were, as you say, testing far fewer people. And so this number is bad. It's not a good number by any stretch. But on its own, in isolation, it doesn't tell us that much. We are seeing far fewer people hospitalized than we were earlier in the pandemic, and far fewer deaths. Those are both obviously good things, relatively speaking. The bad news is that at the moment, the trajectory we're on is really bad, and infectious disease experts around Ontario are ringing the alarm bells pretty loudly right now. Just as one example, and Dr. Beata Sander of the University of Toronto tweeted that Ontario's current path looks similar to that of the state of Victoria in Australia. Victoria, and specifically the city of Melbourne, they had to go into a pretty severe lockdown in August because of the growth in cases there. Like every major Western government, we're trying to preserve hospital capacity. So, spikes in COVID-19 cases, even if they don't necessarily lead to as many fatalities, they can really throw hospitals into chaos. On that note, the Ontario Hospital Association is worried about preserving hospital capacity, and they are calling for a return to stage 2 restrictions, at least in the GTA and Ottawa, where we've seen really the core of this outbreak. Maybe we can avoid a new lockdown in Ontario if these numbers start turning around very quickly. And we should also say that some of that number might be because we are actually starting to chew through a backlog of testing that had built up last week. So these are not all necessarily people who, got sick over the weekend. These are people who got tested maybe as early as Monday or Tuesday, and they only got their results on Sunday or Monday. So those are the kinds of things that might be making the number look potentially bigger than it would otherwise be. But it's concerning, right? The trajectory we're on is bad. These cases really are going up very quickly, and we don't want them to put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. The next week's worth of tests is really going to tell the story, but unfortunately, those results are kind of already baked in. The next week's worth of results that we get are going to be people who already got sick in the last few days. So I'm left here not really knowing what advice to give people other than to say it's never too late to start minimizing your social contacts and stop whatever spread you can.
No, indeed. And that's all really good context to keep in mind as we consider that 700 figure. Having said that, the Premier was back to his very grim self at Monday's daily briefing. I mean, he was begging people to go get a flu shot. He was begging people to download the COVID app to their smartphones, said he'd done it himself. And he announced a $52 million program to recruit and retain 3,700 more nurses and PSWs to fight COVID, and he's offering a $5,000 incentive bonus to those who promise to work in a long-term care home for 6 months. Now, through your eyes, does this look like a serious response to the second wave, which he has told us we are now in?
You know, the long-term care sector and the hospitals have been crying out for staff, for just labor. They need manpower. And I spoke with some people, gosh, is that 2 weeks ago now? I'm losing track of time, in the hospital sector, who, and particularly the long-term care sector, where I was told that in some ways they're even less prepared for a second wave than they were for the first one in March, or at least they're in worse shape than they were by April, May, when we had hospitals and even the military going into Ontario's long-term care homes. Most of that immediate surge of assistance that was provided to long-term care homes has now gone away. The military has gone back to their peacetime duties, and hospitals are busy trying to clear out the backlog of procedures that they ran up during the shutdown. So the long-term care sector is desperate to find manpower just to get back to where they were in the spring. So in that sense, I mean, this announcement is good. Thousands of more workers will definitely get used. There's not going to be anybody sitting around counting their pennies with this announcement. But I got to say, it's certainly the kind of announcement that would have been better on September 1st instead of almost October 1st.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and incidentally, I'm old enough to remember when the Department of Employment and Immigration used to be called the Department of Manpower, and they changed the name because I'm pretty sure you can't say that anymore, JMM.
yes, I'm archaic terminology. I apologize.
Staffing, resources, whatever. Anyway, different nomenclature now. Let me throw this on the table, because you and I normally don't talk too much about our personal circumstances on this podcast, but I think we might make an exception to that rule today because, well, how do I put this? My 17-year-old daughter's school sent a note home at the end of last week saying, "Confirmed, we have our first case of COVID-19 at the school your daughter attends." And they wouldn't say if it was a student, or if it was a student, what grade the student was in, or whether it was a teacher or a staff member or a caretaker or administrator or whatever. They didn't say any of that. I guess they're concerned about protecting privacy. But it was a quick reminder that as much as most of us want to get our kids back into school and learning again, and of course we want them doing so safely, and we don't want them bringing anything dangerous home, easier said than done. How's the situation going with your daughter?
She's had all of 4 days of school because last week on Monday, she woke up with a sore throat. And so obviously we weren't going to send her into school, and we got her tested. And as far as the actual testing was concerned, it was relatively painless. My wife took her to the hospital on Monday, and they were in and out pretty quickly. I believe it was like an hour and a half, 2 hours, something like that. And I'm going to do a little bit of paternal bragging. My 4-year-old daughter took the nasal swab like a champ, didn't cry or anything.
You sound like Premier Ford here. Your daughter's a real champion, eh? A real champion.
The problem on our end was that we didn't get the test results until Thursday, I believe. And, you know, in our case, my daughter was still clearly symptomatic, so we weren't going to send her back regardless. But that was a 4-day wait for test results. And I know I certainly was not the only person last week who spent at least that long waiting. It does seem to be a real mix. I know some people who got their results in under 24 hours, and other people who waited even longer than I did. But for me, that was my little personal experience of the pandemic last week.
Well, don't keep us in suspense any longer. How did the results come back?
Oh, both are negative. Both my daughter and wife tested negative. I did not get tested on the assumption that we were trying to maybe ration tests a bit more. And so I figured if one of them came back positive, then I would make an appointment.
Okay. Well, first of all, congratulations. That's good news. I'm glad they're both negative. But this is also an example that illustrates the fact that, the decision you made, you are in fact reflecting the new criteria, which the province of Ontario has changed in terms of who can get a test now. It used to be if you wanted a test, go get a test. That's not the case anymore. What's the story now?
Yeah, if your only reason for wanting a test is that you want one, you're out of luck now. They have changed the rules. The Premier and Health Minister said last week that there was too much of what they called reassurance testing. People who are low risk and didn't have symptoms, basically gumming up the testing pipeline. So now tests are restricted to people who either have symptoms or people who have close contact with confirmed cases, and other high-risk people like healthcare workers or PSWs in long-term care. You know, if you get a ping on that COVID alert app, for example, that counts as a contact, and you can feel free to maybe, I don't know, bring your phone into the testing center and show them the alert. But it's definitely a more restricted set of people they are looking to see as far as testing goes now. One important point that I don't think was super clear in the announcement last week, but is or could be relevant to our listeners. If you have a family member who's in long-term care and you are trying to visit them, the new rules do say you should be able to get a test. If you do not have symptoms and you're in one of those groups who otherwise is still eligible to get a test, you can, of course, go to many of the pharmacies that are now opening up, I believe 70-odd by the end of this week. And there are lists online as to where you can get tested. I believe you do have to make an appointment.
Mm-hmm. Well, this all speaks to a bigger issue here, which is essentially, from whom do we get our advice on, you know, what protocols to follow? You know, is it supposed to be politicians? Is it supposed to be public health officials? Is it supposed to be teacher union leaders, for that matter? You know, with all the kids in school now, or certainly many of the kids in school now, we're certainly taking some cues from teachers and teacher union leaders. Well, why don't you take it from there? Because you have interviewed an expert on this who can give us some guidance on whose responsibility, in fact, it is to advise us on what to do.
As it turns out, on Monday, I thought the Premier and Ontario's Chief Medical Officer of Health set up this topic pretty perfectly. Here's a quick clip from the Premier's scripted remarks on Monday.
We know that this wave will be more complicated, more complex. It'll be worse than the first wave we faced earlier this year.
And here's what Dr. David Williams, the chief medical officer, said only minutes later.
So I think the potential is that it can be worse.
So we've got our most prominent leaders during the pandemic being about as clear as mud, if I could say so. politicians, doctors, journalists, we have all been struggling to try and guide the public on how best to respond to something that really none of us have any experience with. I certainly was not a healthcare specializing reporter before any of this. But clear and effective communications may actually be as important as any mask. I spoke with someone who has studied the provincial government's communication response along with that of British Columbia's and nine countries. Her name is Dr. Heidi Twarek. She is an associate professor at the University of British Columbia. And she and her team compared the pandemic responses between Ontario and BC, and they found some really interesting differences. Here's my interview with Dr. Heidi Twarek. Heidi Twarek, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your study looked at several countries and their communication strategies regarding COVID-19. What did you find?
So we found that despite the fact that these were nine democracies located in five continents around the world, those that successfully communicated around COVID-19 adhered to a few basic principles, some of which were actually quite surprising, like relying more on autonomy than enforcement orders and shaming. And we also found that they tried to describe this crisis democratically, to make it something that citizens experienced together, rather than something that was dominated by top-down orders from public health officials.
You have a sentence that actually it caught me a bit in the beginning of the report, where you say, and I believe it's something like, communications are an effective non-pharmaceutical intervention for COVID-19. You're saying a lot in that sentence, and I'm wondering if I could just draw you out a bit on that. You know, communications as a form of medical intervention?
In a way, so as a form of health intervention. So right. To explain what non-pharmaceutical interventions are, they're all the sorts of things that actually we've spent a lot of time talking about. Masks, personal protective equipment. And one of the major points we wanted to make in this report is effective communications that are clear are also an effective non-pharmaceutical intervention because they can help people understand what the guidelines are, feel like they want to adhere to them, and they can also help to prevent some of the many other problems that we see spiraling out from COVID-19, including increased depression and anxiety. So what we really wanted to say here is effective communications are really important. We need to have this at the heart of our strategies in responding to COVID-19 and not just have a conversation that, circulates around masks and PPE, as crucial as those things are.
You looked at several different countries, as you say, on different continents. What have they done right?
So to give you a list of the countries that we looked at, to give you a sense of how diverse they were, we looked at South Korea, Taiwan, New Zealand, Senegal, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Canada. So these are all very, very different countries, but have in their own ways been quite successful. And we developed basically five principles. So we call them the rapid principles. And one of the things that we found was that these principles are quite contextual. So how exactly they get implemented in each of these places depends a little bit. So I can tell you what the five are if you'd like. So the R is relying on autonomy, not orders, which doesn't mean there's no enforcement, but that public health officials try to trust in their populations rather than shame them. A is attending to values, emotions, and stories. So not just facts, important as they are, but giving emotional heft, telling stories about individuals, and thinking about societal values to drive people to comply. The P is pulling in citizens and civil society, which is why the response in each of these countries was so different, because their populations are so different. And the I is institutionalizing communication, so having communications units, people who spend all their time thinking about how to communicate effectively. And the D is describing it democratically.
What do you make of the way that Ontario has approached our COVID-19 communication strategy in this province?
So I'm glad you asked that, because one of the other things that we did was we compared British Columbia and Ontario. So we looked at the two provinces to see how their communication strategies have differed. And we did find that in many cases, Ontario has not necessarily adhered to the principles that we outline. To give just a couple of examples, it's not always clear that the descriptions of what's going on are particularly democratic. There's a lot of use of military metaphors, for example, which we find is not as effective. It implies sort of top-down, somewhat authoritarian response, whereas we find that other metaphors and ways of describing this will help people to feel like they're actually part of a larger societal effort to fight this disease. And we also find there have been many different communicators, which makes it quite confusing for people. And also that the constant changes of guidelines mean that often when people are not adhering, it may not be because they don't want to, but it's because they're actually confused about what they're supposed to be doing.
That is what Ontario has maybe done wrong or failed at. The contrast is with British Columbia. What has BC done right?
BC was a really interesting response because it's actually quite traditional in many ways. Unlike South Korea or Taiwan, which were very technologically savvy, BC has just used traditional instruments extremely well and effectively. Press conferences, Bonnie Henry has done an excellent job, not just of communicating the public health guidelines, giving memorable slogans, but also attending to the emotions of the pandemic, how people might feel. You can think of her famous slogan, be kind, be calm, be safe. That also includes the kind of emotions that we might exhibit to other members of the community. They've also done a good job in general of being quite consistent and clear in their guidelines. So things don't change too much. And they've also given a decent space for autonomy and for businesses and others to come up with their own plans and figure out how to communicate them to people in their community. So there are, of course, guidelines, but different businesses can decide exactly how they want to implement them in consultation with things like WorkSafe BC. And we find that giving people some room for autonomy actually does help in the long run and communicating that.
You mentioned that shaming doesn't work, and I want to drill down on that a bit because I think it's an important point. Why doesn't shaming work?
Yeah, it's a counterintuitive point in a way, because when we see pictures of people who seem to be violating physical distancing guidelines, we all want to sort of shake our fists and fine them. But what we find is that in the long run, having trust in your community, emphasizing the many people who are actually adhering to the guidelines, makes people want to comply in the long run. The other thing that we find is that it does seem like many of the fines and other things are actually going towards people who are already disadvantaged in some way. So it actually ends up reinforcing inequalities within society. But the main point is, this is a long run. COVID-19 is going to be a marathon. We need to keep people on board with public health guidelines for a long time. And shaming them tends to make them give up on complying rather than making them want to comply in the long run. So it's very important to keep building trust in a population, avoiding that blame game, because it might feel satisfying in that moment, but in the long run, it really doesn't increase compliance with guidelines.
And I just think of a few examples in Ontario that we've had where there have been explosions of outrage about, you know, crowds at parks or whatever. And then it turns out that as much as people want to shame, you know, young people going out and having social lives, it turns out that, in fact, we don't actually see a major outbreak in cases related to those events.
Yeah, right. And also, I would say it's been one of the big problems of reporting around these sort of shamings is that often they're accompanied by pictures of people being outside when we really do know that being outside is far, far safer than being inside. And so ironically, these sort of shame spirals and blame spirals have potentially been very counterproductive in pushing people away from gathering outdoors. And I would also add that sometimes the camera lens is very deceiving because the camera lens can appear to make it seem like everybody's very close together. And I've seen some of those pictures, right, of beaches in Vancouver that I've then walked to and seen, no, people are actually far apart. It's simply the camera lens. So I think exactly that desire to shame people is often focused on the places where you see people, which is outside. But in fact, if we look at the research, you are far less likely to catch this disease from gathering with someone in a physically distanced way outside than inside. So we can see some ways in which these blame and shame games have actually been very, very counterproductive.
We are just today in Ontario, as we record this, getting changes in some of the public health guidance, and there's been a few changes recently. The science of COVID-19 is changing regularly, and here in Ontario, the government is shifting with the science. How rapidly should governments be communicating about the changes in knowledge, the changing in science?
This is a really good question, because it's one of the key challenges we have about a novel coronavirus, meaning a new disease about which we are still learning a tremendous amount. We've seen a lot of governments and public health officials struggle to explain what I might call the meta-narrative of science, which means how scientific discovery really works, that there's peer review, that scientists change their mind, that it's actually a good thing if we know more about this disease and our minds are being changed because we have greater evidence. And we've seen a lot of public health officials and journalists struggle to really explain that this is how science works, this is why we're getting new information, and then to figure out how to convey that new information to populations in a way that they trust. We've seen the framing around flip-flopping around masks is, I think, a very good example, whereas actually we could frame it as, listen, science and the scientific discoveries around it are changing dramatically, and we are updating our guidelines accordingly because our main goal is to keep you safe. So I'd say that's one part of it, is that governments really need to think about how they educate people about how scientific discovery really works. And the second part of it is the question of conveying uncertainty, helping people understand we still have many aspects of this disease that we don't understand well. Long COVID, so COVID long haulers, is just one example of that, where there's still a lot that we don't know. So I think that's the second piece. And then the third piece of what you are asking about is governments changing guidelines and how that should work. And I think what we have seen is that frequently changing guidelines become very confusing because it's hard to reach your diverse population at the same time to inform them about that. So the more that you can have, as BC does, guidelines that are relatively clear and you make small tweaks, or we saw in New Zealand, there's a very clear four-stage plan. Everybody knows what the four stages are. And then if there's a problem, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern can simply say, we are now going to stage X, and everybody understands what that means. But continually changing guidelines becomes very confusing in the end.
And sometimes the guidelines themselves can end up being confusing or unhelpful. And I'm thinking here of the social circles idea in Ontario, where people were told that they could have, you know, close contacts with up to 10 people. And I think it's increasingly being regarded as a bit of a failure in terms of controlling the spread of the pandemic, because people don't understand it and they're just having multiple overlapping social circles.
Right, exactly. And one of my co-authors on this report, Ian Beacock, who was looking into that, points this out as something that's an example of what was very confusing in Ontario, whereas the BC guidelines, which actually have never changed from saying the maximum number of people who could gather is 50, but you see in a restaurant, you're actually not allowed to have more than six people at a table. And there was never any sort of flip-flopping on things like bubbles. So it does make it easier for people living here to understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing.
How can governments build better public trust, for lack of a better word?
It's a great question. So we advise obviously following the principles that we lay out. And I think the other important bit of this that we saw was really trying to meet citizens where they're at, to gain a good understanding of what it is that's happening with them. Canada has a very diverse population. People who speak multiple languages are invested in different things. And it's really important to have a communication strategy that really tries to meet people where they're at on the many, many channels they're at, right? Whether it's radio, TV, the more traditional channels, but there's Snapchat and WhatsApp and the TikToks, et cetera, et cetera. So this means that actually, in a way, it's much harder to do this kind of communication than it was 25 years ago when there were a smaller number of channels. But it also means that you can really try to direct your messages and have conversations with different segments of the population. So I think understanding that you've got to use as many channels as possible and that you've got to listen to your population as much as you speak to them. And that's what we saw in our successful examples. These were two-way streets. They were not one-way top-down authoritarian messaging.
Okay. Professor Heidi Twerk, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dr. Heidi Twerk, Associate Professor at the University of British Columbia. Well done, JMM. Okay, we always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have those for you immediately. After we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, let us know what you liked, what you didn't like, and help us make this podcast just a little bit better.
If you'd like to send us a comment, shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org or tweet at us. I'm at JM_McGrath.
And I'm at SPAIKIN, that's SPAIKIN.
Subscribe to the On Poly podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Here now, my quote of the week from last week, and it's Premier Doug Ford showing just a bit of one-upsmanship against his fellow Conservative Premier in Alberta, Jason Kenney.
Well, good question. But again, if we're going to start comparing provinces, we're kicking Alberta's butt. Simple. And I love Jason. He's a pal of mine. But since you're comparing it, we're way ahead of Alberta. We're way ahead of BC and Quebec and everywhere else. We're doing a great job.
Doug Ford, reminding everyone that Ontario is better than Alberta.
Doing your part for national unity, right, Steve?
There you go. Yeah. Not so much.
My quote of the week comes from Eileen Davila, the medical officer of health for Toronto. She spoke last Friday about the city's growing number of cases, and she and the city's mayor, frankly, like the premier this week, they both sounded more anxious and grim than I've heard in a while. What Dr. Davila said isn't new, but it might be worth a refresher for some people.
Wherever you live, wherever daily life takes you, you must take the steps for self-protection that we advise you to take. Watch your distance, keeping at least 6 feet apart whenever you can from anyone you don't live with. Wear a mask, again, as much as you can, and certainly when you are in situations where you can't keep at least 6 feet distance from anyone you don't live with. And wash your hands often. These three actions done together will reduce the risk of COVID-19. And if you're not being disciplined about them, I ask you to please start.
That's Toronto's Dr. Eileen Davila, all but begging people to take more serious measures to control the spread of COVID-19. As we mentioned earlier, Toronto saw 344 new cases on Monday, nearly half of the provincial total.
And so ends episode number 81 of the On Poly podcast. It was produced by Katie O'Connor with editing wizardry from Matthew O'Mara. Our production support coordinators are Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Halliwell. JMM, as my dad likes to say, and particularly important these days when the numbers are going back up, stay positive, but test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.